Welcome back to In Search Of, the podcast where we go in search of voices and ideas that expand and enrich a life of faith. I'm your host, Amy Frickholm, and before we begin today, I want to tell you about a special opportunity for an adventure that I will be leading this summer, along with pastor and writer Melissa Early. We will be leading a small retreat in the High Rockies called Discovering Your Spiritual Autobiography. We will be leading retreatants through exercises designed to reflect on various stages of our spiritual lives. We'll identify mentors and inspired moments, we'll demarcate chapters, and we'll wonder about the future. It's a writing-intensive retreat, but participants will have time to gather as a community, get outdoors in gorgeous, historic Leadville, Colorado, and find renewal in the mountain air. For more information about this retreat, go to sagemountaininstitute.com. That's sagemountaininstitute.com. Up until now, this season, we've been exploring the lives of particular women, named and unnamed, whose stories have been important in one way or another to ancient Christianity. Now we're fast-forwarding a whole bunch of centuries for the next three episodes of this season. That means that we're basically skipping the entire Middle Ages, the Reformation, the Renaissance. We're excluding not only whole time periods, but also whole continents. It's painful when I think about my ambitions for this season. Think about women like Haidewitch of Antwerp, or my colleague John Matthews' favorite name to say, Mechtild de Bagdeburg, or the Ethiopian saint Christos Samra, or the sarcastic philosopher-poet Cassia, who wrote this ditty called On Stupidity, which I can only think was composed on a very bad day. On Stupidity. There is absolutely no cure for stupidity, nor help except death. A stupid person, when honored, is arrogant towards everyone, and when praised, becomes even more overconfident. Just as it is impossible to bend a great pillar, so it is to change a stupid person. Don't you just suddenly feel closer to this Cassia, even if you are momentarily worried that you are the stupid person she's referring to, or that she might somehow turn her gaze on you? Anyway, we're saving all of that for another time. In spite of all that we're not doing on this season of In Search Of, I am so excited about today's interview. Today, we're going to bring this search very close to home and spend some time with a much overlooked aspect of American history. I am joined by Dr. Shannon D. Williams, who's the author of a new book called Subversive Habits that traces the history of Black women religious in American culture. This is a startlingly fascinating history, with complicated and brave women trying to imagine a better future for themselves and for generations that they would never live to see. And in no small number of cases, their accomplishments and critical insights were simply stolen by others, while their names and records remained buried. In recent decades, there has been a Black sainthood movement where a grassroots community has been urging the Pope to recognize six African American saints. Of these, four are women, and we will hear about most of them in today's episode. This is an important movement because there are currently no Black Americans who have been recognized for sainthood, a reality that underscores the dynamics of erasure that Dr. Williams addresses in her book and on this episode. Welcome to In Search Of, Dr. Williams. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Williams, I wanted to start with the stories of some of these women so that we could sort of ground ourselves in their realities and in their world and actually have in our minds some images of human beings who lived these lives before we go into the deeper context and all of the things that you explore in your book. If you could just introduce us to a couple of these sisters.
Absolutely. Subversive Habits in many ways tells what I consider to be the story of America's Real Sister Act, the story of how generations of African-American Catholic women and girls fought against discrimination and exclusion to be able to answer God's call in their lives and minister as consecrated women of God in the Roman Catholic Church. We know that over 2,500 African-American women have entered religious life in the U.S. Church. Three of those women are currently on the road to sainthood. Currently, there are six African Americans on the road to sainthood, four of which are women, three of which are sisters. The first of those women is Venerable Mother Mary Lange, who is the foundress of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, which is the nation's and the modern world's first Roman Catholic sisterhood freely open to African descended women and girls. They are founded in Baltimore, Maryland in 1829. And their chief architect, Mother Mary Lange, who was born Elizabeth Clarice Lange, is in many ways one of the great revolutionary figures of the early American church. She is born in Cuba to Haitian parents and immigrates to the United States in the chaos of the Haitian Revolution, or what becomes the slave rebellion that becomes the Haitian Revolution, and eventually settles in Baltimore, Maryland, where there is a large free and enslaved Black population that is French-speaking and that is Catholic. And she comes to us first in the records as members of some of the earliest confraternities of women in the Diocese of Baltimore, which is our nation's oldest diocese. And she and two friends and several friends are close friends, and then more will join her, are running a school for Black children out of her home because, unfortunately, Baltimore is a slave society, and racism is the dividing factor of society and the Roman Catholic Church. Most of the educational institutions run by the church, all of the educational institutions run by the church at that time would not accept African-American children. And there are very few schools open to Black children at that time. And so they are running this school to be able to serve a community that is being neglected. They're also running this school because these are women who feel called to religious life. And we know that she and the early members of the Oblate Sisters of Providence have experienced some level of rejection from the earliest communities of sisters that are ministering in the Diocese of Baltimore. And so she founds this community with the support of a French priest. The story of the Oblate Sisters of Providence is so important to us because they are among the earliest Catholic sisters to minister in what becomes the United States. They are also significant to us because they are not a slaveholding community, unlike most of their counterparts. Indeed, the story of Mother Mary Lange and her early Oblate Sisters of Providence serve as the essential counterpoint to any person who dares to try to defend or excuse their slaveholding and segregationist counterparts as simply people of their times. We must always remember that Mother Lange and her Oblate Sisters of Providence were people of those times. These were women who never relied on slave labor, never enslaved people, never operated Native American boarding schools, and never barred any person into their ranks or any of their institutions on the basis of color and race. And so it reminds us that these practices of slaveholding and segregation and exclusion and cultural denigration were choices that were made by women religious, and that the Oblate Sisters of Providence have been our moral compass. And so if there is certainly one person's story that I will always tell is Venerable Mother Mary Lange. The second African-American, successful African-American sisterhood in the United States was founded by the second woman that I think everyone should know, African-American sister, and that is Venerable Henriette DeLisle. Like her counterparts in Baltimore, Maryland, Henriette DeLisle is a devout Black Catholic woman called to religious life, but with no options to pursue her vocation to religious life due to the anti-Black admissions policies of the communities of sisters in Louisiana, which is another cradle of American Catholicism. And so we know that she and several close friends who feel called to religious life attempt to found several communities before they're successful in founding the Sisters of the Holy Family in New Orleans, Louisiana in 1842. They are actually the first Catholic sisterhood to be established in the state of Louisiana, which is a big deal. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't Catholic sisters ministering in Louisiana before them, but they are the first to have their mother house established in the state of Louisiana. Also, like their counterparts in Baltimore, the early Sisters of the Holy Family, along with Henriette DeLisle, are women who are of mixed racial ancestry. And indeed, it is their story that reminds us, one, that the African foundations of U.S. Catholicism are just as old as the European foundations of Catholicism, that there were always two transatlantic stories of American Catholicism, one that begins in Europe, and another one that begins with African descended people who are living in Europe in the 15th century, and those who come as a result of the transatlantic slave trade. And so many of these women who are members of the Oblate Sisters of Providence and then later the Sisters of the Holy Family are women who could trace their lineage to the earliest days of the U.S. Church and to both the free and enslaved people who helped to build it. So in the case of Venerable Henriette DeLisle, we know that she is the great-great-granddaughter of Claude de Bruyé, who is the inaugural French Royal Engineer, whose crews of free and enslaved men built the earliest structures in New Orleans, including the earliest canals, the earliest levees, also the old Ursuline Convent, which ironically, Henriette DeLisle would never be able to enter because of her African heritage and her unwillingness to pass for white. So also like her counterparts in Baltimore, Henriette DeLisle is also concerned about the neglected African descended children in the Diocese of New Orleans, which is now the Archdiocese of New Orleans. And so she and her friends are also called to an educational ministry. What's really important about Henriette DeLisle, like her counterparts in Baltimore, is that she herself is also of mixed ancestry. In fact, she is the great-great-granddaughter of Claude de Bruyere, who was the inaugural French Royal Engineer, whose crews of free and enslaved men helped to build many of the earliest structures in New Orleans, including many of the earliest roads, the canals, the levees, and also, ironically, old Ursuline Convent, which Henriette DeLisle would never be able to enter due to her African heritage and her unwillingness to pass for white. And the Ursulines are, in fact, the first congregation of sisters to minister in the land area that becomes the United States when they arrive in New Orleans in the late 18th century. Although they briefly established a ministry to the African descended community, they, to this date, until all of our records, have never accepted an African descended woman into their ranks. Although we know that there are plenty of vocations that were there, most of which are directed to the Sisters of the Holy Family when they are finally established in 1842 in New Orleans. Like their counterparts in Baltimore, the Sisters of the Holy Family are women who feel called to religious life with no avenue to pursue their vocations, but also who have evidenced a revolutionary commitment to the education of Black children, both free and enslaved. So what's really important about their story, in the case of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, Mother Lange's Oblate Sisters of Providence, their St. Francis Academy in Baltimore, which is still open, is the nation's oldest continuously serving Black Catholic school. The second oldest continuously serving Black Catholic school is St. Mary's Academy in New Orleans, Louisiana, established by Venerable Henriette DeLisle. Now, I do want to note that there are some differences between the Oblate Sisters of Providence and the Sisters of the Holy Family. The Sisters of the Holy Family, we do know, initially established a admissions policy based on color, an exclusionary admissions policy based on color. And so initially, until the Civil War, only women of free elite backgrounds could enter that community. They would not accept women who were enslaved and also darker skin. The Oblate Sisters of Providence, on the other hand, established by Venerable Mother Mary Lange, before the Civil War, accepted at least 8 women into their community who were born into slavery. And so they also are that first Roman Catholic sisterhood in the United States to reject the racist and sexist notion that a woman born into slavery lacked the virtue necessary to enter religious life. The Sisters of the Holy Family will not do that until after the Civil War. They are also different in another distinct way from the Oblate Sisters of Providence in the fact that it does seem that at least 2 of the early members of the Sisters of the Holy Family owned enslaved people. Now, they are different from their white counterparts in that they do not trade. There are no records suggesting that they trade or expand their slaveholding property. We know that it seems that those 2 women inherited enslaved people from their families. And certainly in the case of Venerable Henriette DeLisle, we know that according to her will, she's attempting to protect and free the woman who she owned. But that is the distinction, and which is why the Oblate Sisters of Providence are those essential counterpoints. I also want to mention just a couple of other women. Sister Thea Bowman is the 3rd African-American sister on the road to sainthood. She desegregates the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, in 1953 when she's just a teenager. And in many ways, she's representative of that generation of African-American Catholic women and girls who are able to begin to desegregate the nation's historically white and white ethnic sisterhoods after World War II. And in my book, I underscore that these women are a forgotten generation of African-American freedom fighters and desegregation foot soldiers. We forget sometimes that when African-American women and girls had to desegregate white communities, they did not have the luxury as their secular counterparts to go home at night. When they desegregated a white sisterhood, they had to desegregate the sisterhood, the convent, oftentimes the universities and schools where the sisters were educated, where they taught. Also, the sundown towns and neighborhoods with restrictive covenants where African-Americans were otherwise not allowed to live, the hospitals, the parishes where their community served. And so these are women who are doing this around the clock, And this is in the generation before, you know, the famous kneel-in protest to be able to desegregate the most segregated hour. But these are young women who are doing this as teenagers, oftentimes hundreds and even thousands of miles away from their hometowns, because many of them have to make those trips to enter communities willing to accept them. They're away from the communities that had nurtured their vocations, and they are what I consider to be forgotten freedom fighters, forgotten desegregation pioneers. I also want to mention one sister whose name has come back to us in recent years, Sister Mary Aloysius Beecraft, who was born Anne Marie Beecraft. The name may be familiar to some listeners simply because her name has come back as a part of Georgetown University's ongoing efforts to make reparation for their slaveholding past. When the university decided to rename some buildings after some of the Jesuits who were involved in that very infamous sale that they had made in the 19th century to secure their financial future, students selected Anne Marie Beecraft, whose name they got from historical records because they found out that she was an early Black educator in Washington, D.C. In fact, in the early first national report on education offered by what becomes the Department of Education, she is described as the most remarkable colored girl of her time in the District of Columbia and perhaps of any time. She actually established one of the earliest Black schools open to children in Washington, D.C., and the first Catholic school opened in the district. What we also know, she eventually becomes an Oblate Sister of Providence, but she gains the support of the slaveholding communities of priests and sisters in Washington, D.C. She's described in the account for being very beautiful, but for being very pious, for being very intelligent. But we also know that according to the surviving records, she is the paternal granddaughter of Charles Carroll of Carrollton, who is the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, who was a descendant of the famous Carroll family, who was one of the earliest families, a Catholic family, to settle in Maryland. Charles Carroll of Carrollton, in addition to being the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, was cousin to Bishop John Carroll, who was the first Catholic bishop in the United States. He is also one of Maryland's largest landowners and enslavers. And the record tells us that Anne's father, William Beecraft, was Charles Carroll's natural-born son. That means then that Anne Marie Beecraft, who became Sister Mary Aloysius, an Oblate Sister of Providence, is the only Catholic sister that we have on record to have a literal birthright and blood right, not only to the nation, but to the church, and that comes through the Carroll family. I also want to mention Sister Mary Antona Igbo, whose image is on the cover of my book. Her story in many ways frames my book. In 1965, Sister Mary Antona Igbo is one of the first member of the first delegation of Catholic sisters to go to Selma, Alabama in 1965 in support of Black voting rights. She famously gives an address to reporters during her time in Selma in which she says, "I'm here today because I'm a Negro, a nun, and a Catholic, and because I want to bear witness." She also mentions in that conversation that she had voted in St. Louis previously, the earlier day, the day before, and that she wanted to come to Selma to make sure that every person had a right, every citizen had a right to vote. There's also another interesting sort of encounter that she has with the press, because they are shocked by the presence of this Black nun among this delegation of six Catholic sisters. And they wonder if, in fact, she's Black. And, you know, she says very clearly, I am a Negro. And I'm very proud of it. But it's that moment that one not only solidifies the place of Catholic sisters in their rightful place in the civil rights movement, but also makes sure that Black sisters are there from the very beginning. Sister Mary Antona Igbo is a member of the earliest generation of African-American Catholic women and girls who were able to begin to desegregate white sisterhoods after 1945, after the end of World War II. And she is among the first women accepted into the Sisters of St. Mary, who are now the Franciscan Sisters of Mary, which were a nursing community in St. Louis. And like many pioneering Black sisters in white communities, she endures unconscionable racism. Even though she's admitted into the community along with four other women in 1946, they are admitted only on a segregated basis. The community builds a separate novitiate for them to live. They enforce segregation in dining, socializing. They're not even able to enter the doors of their mother house for the first few years of their time in the community. And only after that, they have to enter in through the back doors. also very significant about her journey is that she is among a handful of African-American Catholic sisters who we know who went into white communities, were forced to profess their vows in a segregated ceremony. And they actually have a photograph of it. If you do read my book, I argue that that photograph in which those sisters are making a segregated profession in a segregated church, making their way to a segregated altar, is in fact the more honest depiction of the role of Catholic sisters in the African-American freedom struggle, because it reminds us first that white sisters, even those considered to be racially progressive, how far they were willing to go to demand subordination and subjugation of their Black counterparts within their communities. It also reminds us that it was African-American sisters, both members of white and Black sisterhoods, who are, in fact, perhaps our best models of what it means to fight for racial justice within Catholic boundaries. These were the women who were willing to suffer greatly, to lay bare the evil of white supremacy, to show the world and to shame their counterparts who were committed to racial segregation in a universal church. These were the women who always understood that racism had no place within the church, that it was a violation of church law. The Catholic Church's best teaching, right, that we recognize and affirm the life and dignity of every person. These were the women who always understood that the lives, souls, and futures of Black people mattered and paid for it with their very lives. And so although we see and use all of these iconic pictures of Catholic sisters marching for racial justice in the 1960s, even though they are a very small minority, there is this other freedom struggle that had already preceded that struggle that we can begin to look at it. And so I would argue that that image of Sister Mary Antona making that segregated profession ceremony is that more honest and accurate story and gives us greater insight to what it is meant to be Catholic, not simply Black and Catholic, but what it is meant to be Catholic in America.
Absolutely. I think that that was a really vivid and profound visual example. And there are others in your book that I just won't forget because of the way that you bring those stories to life and allow me to see what's being written in that photograph, what the story that's being written there. And you also talk quite a bit about the heartbreak that many Catholic sisters experienced during this period, during the civil rights period, and the sort of the feeling that they couldn't do the work that they wanted to do in these contexts. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and about what you discovered in your research as you encountered women who had lived through this period, who had dedicated their lives to the church in this way, and then found their hearts just absolutely broken.
You know, thank you so much for that question. I first need to say, although I'm Catholic, I was born into the church. I'm actually the daughter of the first Black woman to graduate from the University of Notre Dame. I had no idea that Black nuns existed in my church. I came to this project really by chance, although the sisters would probably say it's providential serendipity. I was very interested in Black women's activism in the civil rights movement, in the modern African-American freedom struggle. And I was really interested in religious women's contributions to the Black radical imagination of the post-World War II era. I was in graduate school and I came across an article that announced the formation of the National Black Sisters Conference, which was a Black Power Federation of Catholic Nuns that was established in wake of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I experienced what I can only call a metanoia. One, I had to ask that question. One, how did Black nuns exist and why don't I know that they exist? And two, these are women who, through this article, were not only active in the civil rights movement, who were not only some of the major foot soldiers of campaigns for desegregation, but what really struck me was that they were organizing because they were involved, but were trying to become more involved and more invisible and had run into all of these barriers. And so the formation of the National Black Sisters Conference was not only just a national organization of Catholic sisters seeking to sort of combat and dismantle and eradicate racism from their church and wider American society, but also women who were articulating and telling their stories to the public to help us to understand, one, we are here fighting, and two, if you don't see enough of us fighting, there's a reason for that. It's not because we lack a commitment to the fight for racial justice. We are the originators, right, of this, right? They have been in the vanguard, and yet they have been made invisible. And so what they, and I would say other African-American activists of that generation understood, was that one of the greatest weapons of white supremacy, or that the greatest weapon of white supremacy has never been violence, but the ability to erase the history of its violence and its victims. And so these were women coming together who were not only active and seeking to have more and experience more leadership and bring their expertise into this fight, but who also understood that they were being erased in that process. Many of the women who came together to form the National Black Sisters Conference were members of the historically white sisterhood. So they had already desegregated many Catholic colleges, universities, schools as faculty members, et cetera. So they already had a lot of experience. And yet when they wanted to go into more formal organizations, they were running against barriers, largely as a result of racism that they had experienced in religious life that had erected those barriers in the first place. In the case of the African-American sisterhoods, you know, those sisters had always been doing this work. They are marching in large numbers when they can, but also that they are vulnerable because they are Black women. And certainly before the reforms of Vatican II, many of their superiors believed that their primary fight was in the classroom and keeping their schools open. And so there were sisters who wanted to go to Selma who could not go because they could not receive permission, who wanted to participate in other organizations, did so without permission, but also had to suffer the consequences of that. And so what I wanted to underscore in my book is that the freedom struggles that African-American sisters initiated and launched took various forms. They will certainly take on the more traditional forms of people participating in public demonstrations, but a lot of this work is behind the scenes. So even before the Brown decision of 1954, members of the African-American sisterhoods had already begun desegregating Catholic colleges and universities beginning in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And so when we tell those stories, now we find all of these early and pioneering Black professors in white universities, we thought they only came in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we have them in the 40s and the 50s and 60s with pioneering Black sisters generally doing a lot of that hard work. And so for me, what the National Black Sisters Conference did was to create a vehicle to make these women visible and to make the work that they had been doing visible. And because I think what you'll find most interesting and what I found most interesting as a scholar is that many of the stories that we already know that we would sort of consider to be these great stories of desegregation or of the civil rights movement, Black sisters are already there. So I think one of the best examples that I can give is the letter from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail that he releases in 1963, in which he champions the leaders of Spring Hill College, the Jesuits at Spring Hill College, for being the first institution in the state of Alabama to accept African-American students. What Dr. King is unaware of is it's not the Jesuits and their moral compass that is leading this effort. It's literally Black Catholics on the ground, and particularly Black sisters who are ministering in Alabama and also in nearby Mississippi and Louisiana, who are the first Black students at Spring Hill, who have to integrate the summer schools because they have to get their accreditation so they can get their schools accredited. And so that becomes the way in which Black sisters are allowed to be these pioneering foot soldiers, in part because they need to get their schools accredited. And Catholic law and church law basically states that all Catholics must be educated in Catholic schools. And so Black sisterhoods have to find ways to prompt and force the hand of their church to actually live up to its word and its own law so that they can get their schools accredited, which is why Black sisters are desegregating places like Villanova, reintegrating the Catholic University of America at St. Louis University in the 1920s and at Spring Hill in 1946. It's not Dr. King's fault that he doesn't know that it's Black sisters pushing the hand of the Jesuits and forcing the hands of the Jesuits. But those are the kinds of stories and really sort of the leadership of Black sisters, the moral leadership of Black sisters that become visible to us when we begin to center their stories. In the case of the Jesuits, St. Louis University, their first African-American graduate is an Oblate Sister of Providence, Sister Mary Lamenta Short, who earns her degree in 1935 and writes her bachelor's thesis on James Weldon Johnson, the great NAACP leader and author of Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so, again, what we do, and when we begin to narrate the story of Black sisters in the church, or simply to narrate the American Catholic experience from the perspective of Black sisters, what happens is that many of the stories that we've told about ourselves and we have expected to be true are revealed to be myths. And we see the role of Black sisters, their moral leadership, their intellectual leadership, and their activism, and their educational activism, really pushing their church in very important ways to initiate desegregation efforts that have oftentimes been attributed to religious orders of men or to bishops, when in fact it was people on the ground and oftentimes Black women and especially Black sisters doing that critical and necessary moral and intellectual work and labor.
And it shouldn't shock us that this is the case, right? We know this, that often leadership takes credit for movements that are done at the grassroots level, or but what really I feel like should really strike the reader of this book or the listener to this podcast is that these women's stories were rather intentionally erased so that we could tell the story of the moral leadership or whatever of others, so that these stories are actually have been taken out of the record in a certain way so that we can tell these mythological versions of our own virtue or our own desire to desegregate or whatever it is we want to tell that story. And I'm just really struck by that we have to, that in order to tell that other mythological story, we have to erase the story of these women.
Right. It's something that you will encounter as soon as you go into the archive. The one thing about about African-American sisters, the vast majority of African-American sisters who have ministered in the United States have been teachers. If they haven't been teachers, there have been nurses, hospital heads, some lawyers, et cetera, but mostly teachers, mostly professors. And so what does this mean? This means that these women left a lot of traditional records behind. So there is no excuse for us not knowing that history. The archives of the Oblate Sisters of Providence and the Sisters of the Holy Family are two of the richest archives in American Catholic history that we have. And I do not say Black Catholic history. I say American Catholic history because, again, their history intersects with everything else. They are intersecting and corresponding with the earliest bishops in our church. All of them, they are there. They are communities or sisters who have baptismal records, confirmation records. When you apply, the applications are there, the photographs. I mean, the archives are a wealth of material and information on the American Catholic experience. So it's no excuse. And I realized almost immediately when I began my research, I was like, it makes no sense that I'm the first person who's trying to write the first full history of Black Catholic sisters in the United States. It shouldn't have been me. It should not have come in the 21st century. What I had to realize almost immediately is that I was not the first people to encounter their stories in the archive. I was the first person to encounter their stories in the archive to say that they mattered. And I was okay that if it changed the story. That's what happens when we narrate the history of the American Catholic Church from the perspective of Black nuns. Myths about the Catholic past fall quickly and they fall hard. And so, again, it's why the story of Venerable Mother Mary Lange is so important. She's the counterpart. People have made excuses for her counterparts, whether it is Catherine Drexel, whether it is Elizabeth Seton, whether it has been Philippine Duchesne. Oh, well, they participated in slavery, but they are just simply people of their times. Mother Lange is also of those times. She doesn't do it. But if you erase Mother Lange, you don't even have to deal with the contradiction. What happens too? In the case of the African-American sisterhoods, right, I went into this having very little knowledge of the history of racial segregation in women's religious life. So when I began interviewing sisters, and I interviewed over 150, I assumed that those who went into the Black orders went into the Black orders because they had been educated by those sisters. And almost immediately in the archive and in my oral history interviews, they said, oh no, I was educated by this white sisterhood. And I was rejected solely on the basis of race. And I got lucky. Someone directed me and they told me of the existence and made me aware of the existence of the African-American sisterhoods. And so this is what is so significant about the African-American sisterhoods as well. They are made up of women who, again, have traveled hundreds and even thousands of miles away from their hometowns to be able to enter these communities willing to accept their vocations. They are always multi-ethnic and multilingual organizations. That these African-American sisterhoods, the Oblate Sisters of Providence, the Sisters of the Holy Family, the Handmaids of Mary, the Franciscan Handmaids of Mary, there have been 8 in the United States. They are not only preserving the vocations of African-American, they are not only preserving the vocations of Black women and girls whose vocations are rejected by white sisterhoods in the United States, but also in Canada, in Latin America, in the Caribbean as well. And now with the vast majority of the vocations who are coming from Africa, they are truly transnational. I mean, that transnational story is continuing in very interesting ways and thriving when we look at the African diaspora. So it was shocking to me, not only that these women were invisible and that was a choice, but also when you begin to encounter the realities of communities who had destroyed records or limited access to their archives so that people would not find out about their African-American origins or even sort of their slaveholding and segregated past. I think it's important to remember that African-American sisters not only lead, obviously, the earliest Black congregations in the United States, but some of the earliest white and white American communities, like the European too. In the case of the Sister Servants of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the IHM sisters, one of the most distinguished communities of sister educators in the United States that have three colleges, they are founded by two former Oblate Sisters of Providence who left the community to pastor white in Michigan. They are the first community to minister in Michigan. Recently, I was in a conversation with archivists of community women religious, and we found another Black superior in Oregon in the 19th century who founds the first community in Oregon. We're finding them more and more, and we know that many early communities had women who were racially, who were African descended. And I think it's important to really underscore this, right? Communities would take Native American women. They would take non-Black Latina women. They would take women of Asian descent in the early 19th century. Blackness is the bar. And so we also get examples of African descended women who are able to go into communities because they are racially ambiguous. You don't necessarily need to be able to pass for white. You just need to be able to pass as something else. Now, that does not mean that those other sisters of color are welcomed equally in those communities. Many of them are relegated to domestic service. They're not educated, but they can be admitted and they can serve as members of those communities. So Blackness becomes the bar. And it also forces us to really grapple with the power and the effect of the doctrine of discovery, which Pope Francis has finally repudiated. He repudiated it this past summer. And so what does this mean? Because we forget that the Catholic Church was the largest corporate slaveholder in the Americas. The Catholic Church was the institution most responsible for the rise of African slavery in the Americas. So this is why the story of African-American sisterhoods is so powerful. The first global institution to say that the lives of Black people did not matter, these women go into that institution. They embrace the religious state. They say, no one has a right to my body, that I will serve God. And they want to make this church that has enslaved them, that has initiated and profited and from this horrific trade and enslavement of people, indigenous Americans and African descended people, and say, no, their lives do matter. That is why this story is so powerful. The records are there. So that's not an excuse. It forces us to grapple with the role of the Catholic Church in the formation of anti-Blackness, in this history of mostly unreconciled history of colonialism, slavery, and segregation. And that's the issue. As you hit it, and as I stated in my book, you cannot tell these women's stories accurately and honestly without confronting the history of the church's mostly unreconciled practices of colonialism, slavery, and segregation. And so for people who are not willing to confront those realities, they erase the women. They erase the women.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's such an instructive example, and certainly not unique in the history of the world or in the history of the Christian church as we try to reconstruct and tell these stories. I wonder what your work in the archives taught you about Mother Mary Lange's voice. Who was she? What kind of a person are we encountering when we encounter her? If we were to meet her, what would we take away? Who was she?
You know, it's really fascinating to see what's there and what has survived. We only have about one letter from her that we can verify that she wrote. There are very few. Now, there are other records about her. We have the diary of Father James Joubert, who is their French founder. So we get senses of who she is. We have census records because she lives a very long life. But she is a revolutionary in every way that a visibly Black woman living in the slaveholding and segregated American Catholic Church and in the slave society of Baltimore in the 19th century could be. And I mean this in the sense that she founds a community to serve the neglected Black populations, free and enslaved, of Baltimore, Maryland, at a time in which it is oftentimes criminalized, at a time in which Black literacy is criminalized. She is multilingual. We know that she speaks Spanish and French fluently. We also know that she can speak English, but she refuses to do so. And most historians, we say that she does this because even though we know that she can write in English and speak in English, she chooses to only to speak in French and Spanish. And we believe that is because that's her reaction to the racism of the U.S. church, right? That's the one thing that she could do. There is one letter that we have written from her shortly after the formation of her community from 1832. And she's writing to the superior of the Sulpicians. And the Sulpicians were the first order, Roman Catholic order of priests to serve in the United States. And they also serve as supervisors of the Oblate Sisters of Providence because Father James Joubert is a Sulpician. And so the Sulpician Seminary, Father James Joubert's superior, has asked Mother Lange to provide two sisters to serve as domestics at the seminary. The Sulpician Seminary, which is the nation's oldest seminary. The Sulpicians are a slaveholding community, and they are at the Mount in St. Mary's in Maryland, where the Sisters of Charity, where St. Elizabeth Seton Sisters of Charity, another slaveholding community, are established. And so I want you to understand the dangers of what has just been asked of Mother Mary Lange. Her community of teaching sisters who do not engage in domestic work whatsoever are being asked to come and serve and do the very perilous and treacherous work of domestic service in a slaveholding community of priests in training. And it's a very long letter. And this is where we get this description of her as, we are persons of color and religious at the same time. We understand the consequences of what we're being done. And so what she says is, we have to do it. We will do it because we have to submit. That is sort of our role as women religious. Their male superiors are asking us. So she has really no choice but to submit. But she says, we'll do so under certain conditions. That you have to create a space for my sisters to be able to live and work separately from the men and anyone else so that they will not be bothered, that no one should be able to visit them in their quarters. She's offering protection. And she also does something, she asks for protection, and she also does something very radical. She says, with regard to actually serving people meals, she says, under no circumstances will my members take food to the tables of your priest in training. She says, in a house of men, men should do this work. And we have to understand the Catholic Church is the largest corporate slaveholder in the Americas. We have documented examples of enslaved women being sexually abused by priests. When we talk about the history of sexual abuse, the sexual abuse crisis, the fact that we are ignoring those who suffered under slavery and under colonialism has erased so many women victim and girl victims. In the case of the Jesuits, we know one woman in particular, Susanna Queen, but also we know that their practice was to strip women naked and girls naked before they whipped them. In fact, their superiors from Ireland have to come in to tell them to stop whipping enslaved women who are pregnant, to give you a sense of the violence that is very much a part of what it means to suffer under Catholic enslavement. And so when Mother Lange says, in a house of men, that role should be restricted for men, and she is asking for protection. That gives us a very clear sense of her revolutionary mindset. For her to deem herself and dare to profess herself as a consecrated woman of God in Baltimore, Maryland, which is home to one of the largest slave markets in the nation, we have to really understand what this means for these women to say, no one has the right to my body but my God, to wrap themselves up, to really understand celibacy as an act of liberation and Black liberation in the institution most responsible for the enslavement of the vast majority of people in that nation at that time. And so when we ask who Mother Mary Lange was, she is a woman who says, no, we are not going to own enslaved people. Not only are we not going to enslave people and base our life and create our livelihood off of the enslavement of other people, we are going to allow women who were born into slavery into our community. And one of the eight who enter before the Civil War is still enslaved when she enters the community, and she's able to secure her freedom before she's allowed to profess vows. And so when we talk about who Venerable Mother Mary Lange is, she is, again, revolutionary in every way that a visibly Black woman living in the slave society and male-dominated societies of the Americas and of the patriarchal Catholic Church, and she's as revolutionary as one could be. And everything that could have been expected to her, she did. But I would also say she even went further. And that protection of her sisters, to me, is in fact one of the most important pieces of information that we have from her beyond the practice of the community, because that in itself is written in her own voice. And she is trying to protect the women in her community from a violence that she knows is central and foundational to the institution of slavery, and that is the sexual terrorism of white supremacy and of chattel slavery and of colonialism.
That letter really places you, in a sense, in that moment when she receives this request, right, from these priests, like, send us to domestics. And first of all, she's thinking, we don't have those people here. We have teachers here. We have educators here. So it allows you to kind of feel what that must have felt like to get that letter requesting this service and knowing that in many ways you don't have the right to say no. That's the way the church functions. Like you, these are the people who oversee you. They're making this request. You say yes to it. That's the kind of agreement you've entered into. And yet to know that you can't just say yes to that because there's too much at stake for the lives of these women that you are. So that's a really profound, I think, moment that preserves a whole world of a whole reality that is often not seen.
I think you have to remember, and this is something you'll even, if you talk to various oblacers of Providence of every generation, they are always taking the long view. We make the sacrifice now for that next generation. If she had not made that sacrifice and she had said no, at that time, the community was a diocesan community, so could it easily have been, before they become papally approved, you can just easily, the bishop has the right to say, go back into the world, right? And so she has to protect her community while also protecting her sister. She's in a very precarious situation. And she has very little power, right? She has no formal power within this institution. And yet she's able to exert some significant power and preserve her community, protect her sisters, and ensure we think about all of the beneficiary of the, all of the many beneficiaries of the Oblate Sisters of Providence over the decades, over, quite frankly, the century is almost two centuries now. We're at 194. So it matters, right? And I think that's something that we have to think about too, that these were women, and this is true of all of the African-American sisterhoods. They will tell you that they took an unofficial fourth vow, that they would suffer gladly under the burden of white racism for the sake of their communities, for the sake of the preservation of their communities and their schools. It is profound. It is actually one of the it's truly a form of radical activism. It's why when we see that image of of Sister Mary Antoinette Igbo with her counterparts marching down that segregated altar, these are not people who have lost themselves in this church. These are people who are willing to suffer if they can expose the sin of white supremacy. So when you look at these images, why the images are so powerful, when you hear Black Catholics, including sisters, tell you, we went into churches and they pushed us to the back of the communion lines, that the priest would put on gloves before he would offer us the Eucharist. They would switch out the cups, right? That they would not baptize Black children on certain days and whatnot. They say, you know, that's why we went back. It's not that we believed that we were inferior. We made that priest, we made whoever, they make that to disgrace God every time that they did it. That is true power, and not losing yourself and denigrating yourself, but no, going back into that church where you know that you have a rightful place and make that person shame God. So when we look at those images now, there are no two sides to that story. We know who's right and who's wrong in that image. That is a hard struggle to fight, but those sisters fought that. And I hope that I articulated that clearly. And I hope that comes through in Subversive Habits.
And I think that really speaks to the theological essence of the struggle that we're talking about. This, that really is Christianity in a sense at its root, right? That you take on the suffering in order to demonstrate what the kingdom of God really looks like. And so to me, that does speak profoundly, not just to activism, and not, I don't mean just to activism. Activism is obviously one of the most profound voices that we can speak in, but I think it also speaks to the theological essence of deeply understanding what this Christian movement is or might be or could be. I wanted to get your take on the canonization process. Now, I am a Protestant and I'm working for a Protestant magazine, and I don't really understand canonization at any deep level, viscerally. I don't really know what it's about. But I still would love to hear you speak about how you understand now this movement toward the canonization of some of these figures who have been so important in the Black Catholic movement in the Americas, and what you think the value of canonization is, and also what it isn't.
Thank you so much for that question. You know, I'll first talk about just the process of creating a saint, right? Prior to, you know, some of the early saints in the church, they never had to go through this sort of formal process of submitting documents to the Vatican, having that reviewed by the community, the committee, the congregation that basically oversees the process of canonization. So that's why we have a lot of early African saints. But in the modern era, we have very few African descended saints, people who have made it through that entire process. So in the United States, you currently have six African-Americans on the road, six African-descended people on the road to canonization. The funny thing about Martin de Porres, who is the first person of African descent to be canonized from the Americas, while his case is so important to us, I think also telling the story of Ursula de Jesus may help us to really understand why the story from the United States and these six African-American figures is so meaningful, and what I think advocates for the saintly six hope to achieve if they are indeed able to get a fast-tracked but also collective canonization for these efforts. I think the first thing that most Black Catholics will tell you in the United States is that there are plenty of Black saints from the U.S. context, right? It's just that they have not been recognized by the church. There have been plenty of people who have led these saintly lives, and I think that's a story of canonization in itself. There are a lot of people who are probably worthy of canonization whose causes may never even be launched because of the money, the politics, and the time and the efforts that takes in getting someone canonized in the modern era. And again, I think the story of Ursula Jesus gives us a great example. She's probably one of the most famous figures to emerge out of colonial America, Catholic figures, in that she was enslaved by a community of sisters in Lima, Peru, eventually gains her freedom, joins that community, and becomes a very powerful and famous mystic, to the point that two priests have two paintings of her commissioned. And those paintings hung at her convent and hung through the 21st century, where people from the barrio where the community was located were allowed to come in and pray before her body and her paintings because of the very famous sort of person and mystic that she became in the colonial period. She was arguably more famous than Martin de Porres and her female counterpart, St. Rose de Lima. But because though they had causes that were launched through the church, they have become the most famous of those Catholics to emerge from colonial Lima, Peru, where perhaps in their lifetime they did not, they were not as famous as Ursula de Jesus. And so that is what canonization will do, right? To be recognized by the church, because if you are formally recognized by the church, your story can be institutionalized within the church, and it becomes a global story, and you are able to rise from those local origins. And so what does that mean, right? That means that your painting can be held. A painting of you or a statue of you can be placed inside of a sanctuary, any Catholic sanctuary anywhere in the world. You have a feast day that is prayed by Catholics all around the world. And so your story is institutionalized. And so when we think about the U.S. context, although you have a very substantial African-American Catholic community, Black Catholic community, a community whose roots are just as old as anyone else's roots in the United States, in many ways, what contributes to their invisibility is the fact that you don't have saints from their stories. And so that is what advocates for the saintly six are pushing for. It's not simply to recognize people who have lived documented and virtual lives of saints, you know, of saintly lives, but it's the reality that because their lives are not documented, people can make the statement, oh, we didn't know that there were Black Catholics in the United States, right? Oh, we didn't know that Catholicism was the first Black articulation of Christianity in the land area that becomes the United States. It would make no sense to you if we tell you that the first Christian marriage that takes place in the land area that becomes the United States is between a free Black Catholic woman and a Spanish conquistador, right? That doesn't make any sense if you don't know that history. And so what advocates are pushing for is not only a recognition of all of these saintly people, Black people who have lived their lives of consequence and exhibited a courageous and tenacious and uncommon faithfulness in the face of unholy discrimination within their church, how do we get to tell those stories if people don't even know that they're Black Catholics? And what's great about those six African-Americans on the road to sainthood now is that they in many ways embody everyone. We have the story of the Black layman, the Black laywoman, but also the sisters and the priest. And again, just as I said, it's impossible to tell Black sisters' stories without confronting the church's mostly unreconciled histories of colonialism, slavery, and segregation. That's true for all Black Catholics. You can't tell any of those individual stories accurately and honestly without confronting that church's largely unreconciled history of discrimination and anti-Blackness. And so for so many people, what it does in a moment in which Black history is under attack in the secular and private realms, it institutionalizes not only these individuals and the histories that they embody, but also the story of the Black Catholic experience itself. It is a reminder that Black history is and always has been Catholic history. That is what their stories tell us, and that is what most Black Catholics are deeply invested in.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Williams. And thank you for joining me on this podcast. I realize that the email address I've been giving at the end of these episodes has not been working, and I apologize for that if you've been trying to reach me. You can email me at main, M-A-I-N, at christiancentury.org, and also go to our website, christiancentury.org/insearchof, to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us. Also, please follow this podcast and rate it on your favorite podcast app. This helps other listeners find us. This has been a production of the Christian Century, a thoughtful, independent, progressive magazine for today.